Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
This podcast is a Royfield Brown production. Find others on iTunes.
All right. Yeah, I know.
Now, I need you all for a project. James Jeffries, a friend of Robert's, is sponsoring Dumpty Dum. He is very nearly as clever as Robert and, actually, slightly more creative. He builds prototypes for the web and does some amazing things with data for arts and culture. In fact, I may ask him to work on the village website if I can loosen Jennifer's grip on the thing. He's worked with all the best people, you know. The BBC Research and Development team, creating interactive story explorers for Homefront and Peaky Blinders, for the London Philharmonic Orchestra, creating a prototype of a searchable archive of their historic performances. Once, he even built some tweeting receipt printers for a Bill Drummond exhibition. Now, that's the kind of innovation we need for the Village Show. So if you'd like to talk to him about your project idea, you could get in touch with him at Robert, what's his email address? james@shedcode.co.uk. That's james@shedcode.co.uk. Or you could have a browse of his website, shedcode.co.uk. Do tell him I was looking for him if you see him, won't you? I want him to design me a digital resurgence stone.
Hello, everybody at Dumpty Dum. This is Auntie Jean here at the London meetup of Dumpty Dum. We've had a lovely time, and even though Derek in the back bedroom, Royford and Lucy have had to go, the rest of
wonder
us...
Wonder why!
The rest of us are going to sing a Dumpty Dum. So, are we ready, ladies?
Yeah. We are.
One, two, three.
Dumpty 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 Dum, Dumpty Dumpty Da Dum, Dumpty Dumpty Dum, Dumpty Diddly Dum, Dumpty Diddly Dumpty Diddly Dumpty Diddly Dum. Dumpty 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 Dum, Dumpty Diddly Dum.
This is Dumpty Dum, the show about the reality docudrama that's centred on Ambridge in the heart of the Midlands. I'm the ghost of Christmas past, who is Royfield Brown, and with me I have the missing in action, either dead or in Birmingham,
Terry Malloy,
a.k.a. Mike Tucker.
I've got this cold, so I'm talking like somebody from EastEnders, which seems a bit odd, really, because I don't think they'd hire me. I'm fine. I think I've got that terrible cough that everyone's got at the moment. It seems to be going the rounds. I'm all right. I'm okay.
Today's rendition of the Archers theme tune was brought to you by our Auntie Jean and the Dumpty Dum Christmas Posse down there in London. To celebrate Christmas, today's episode is a little different. We take a look back at some of the Christmas storylines in Ambridge over the years. Happens in the Malloy household generally at Christmas time?
Normally the Malloy household is a bit riotous. We usually have a party, well, an open house really, on Christmas Eve. Mm-hmm. You know, just get a load of bottles of Carver in and some nibbles, and people come and go, you know, from about 4 o'clock onwards until we walk around with badges saying, "It's been lovely, but I really now must scream," you know, to usher them out the door. My wife's daughter, who's a wheelchair user, usually comes over from Spain and spends Christmas here. And that's fairly chaotic as well because we have tiny, tiny, teeny, tiny little cottage up in Norfolk. Mm-hmm. But this year, none of that is happening. We've decided this year is a quiet Christmas, and I've woven a lovely little garland. I really object to people calling them wreaths. Those are things you put on coffins. A garland for the front door, a Christmas mm-hmm. garland, with a little hanging humbug in the middle of it, just to show how I feel about Christmas.
So, you're a bit of a Christmas Scrooge this year, just like me. All I want to do, eat my mum's turkey, then just go back into my room and just hibernate until all the fuss is over.
Yeah, I think I want to hibernate from the moment October kicks in, actually. If you can show me a cave with a large pile of leaves, I'd be there until May. You know, I just don't like this time of year. I'm not a winter person at all. We've had great Christmases. I've enjoyed Christmases, but they can also be incredibly taxing and incredibly tiring,
and rather expensive
and very expensive. Absolutely. I remember one year I decided when my kids were in their 10, 11 time, you know, that sort of age. I was fed up with buying large cardboard boxes full of plastic, which they chucked around the room for about 10 minutes and then just were totally disinterested in. So actually living in Birmingham, and you probably might know this, but down in Sturchley, I don't know if it's still there, but there's a place that actually covers billiard tables and things like that. And they do restoring of billiard tables and pub pool tables. So I went and bought a pub pool table, which had been totally restored with all the mechanism. And we had a big house in Birmingham at the time. And I put that in and I said to the kids, that's your Christmas present. It was one of the best Christmas presents they had. They never stopped playing on it, which was great because I'd kept the mechanisms and I had to pay 20 pence every time. But it meant that, you know, after a couple of months, you got enough money to, you know, because all their friends wanted to come around and play, you could rebase the table. You know, they very swiftly found a way around that. And, a couple of times I went in and found there was no coins in it and they'd been playing for about 2 weeks solid, you know. So they found a way of rigging the system. But the great thing is it taught my daughter how to play pool when she was very, very young. And when she started off at university in Aberystwyth some years ago, I took her up there and settled her in her digs. We went down to the pub and there was a couple of Welsh lads in the pub and a pool table. And we said, oh, let's have a knock around. You know, we were just playing silly idiots. And these two guys obviously thought, we're in for a ride here then, you know. So they came over and said, you know, fancy a game for a pint then, is it? And we said, okay, you know, fine, yeah. I mean, not, you know, as I'm played for ages, you know, oh, don't worry, we're not any good either. We said, right, okay. And so I said, Hannah, do you want a break? And Hannah said, yeah, okay. Now, Hannah, you know, in that time was 18 and, you know, very, very long blonde hair, slim, absolute, you know, drop dead gorgeous. I have to say that I'm her daddy, but she is. And she just, you know, racked it up and went whap and then cleared the table. Without leaving it. Not only that, but she was actually saying which pocket she was going to put them in. And you could see these two guys just withering under the fact that they'd actually not only been hooked in and drowned, but now we carried on playing with for the rest of the evening. But it's lovely to have a girl, you know, like that on side who can play really ace pool.
Absolutely. Now, Mr. Malloy, the Christmas panto.
Oh, yeah.
Is somewhat of an archer's tradition.
It's
a little bit repetitive and predictable in terms of the overarching storyline. You know, we have the problems, the director's problems, followed by the play's inevitable success. Why do you think the panto is important to the archers? And how is it possible to rerun the same storyline every year whilst keeping the listeners interested, do you think?
Well, I mean, how many people go to more than one panto in real life? People go back to the panto. They know what it's about. You know, they probably know the stories as well, but they go back because each year is going to be slightly different, you know. And
is that the whole point then, that actually Linda's staging of the panto is the panto?
Yeah, I think so. It is. It's actually a panto in itself. That's the panto, because we never really hear the panto, do we?
No.
had the odd snippet of it. The actual panto is the preparation for the panto. It's you know, it's all the comedy elements are there, all the romance, all the you know, evil villains, they're all there, paraded before you, and you know, you hiss and boo along with them when they say, "I'm going to go to a rehearsal. I'm not going to go to a rehearsal. I'm not wearing that. I'm wearing this. You know, is it going to happen? Will it happen? Oh, the tension. You know, and it all good, comes good in the end. You know, and there's big happy hooray, and everyone pats themselves on the back. I don't know what's going to happen this year. It could be total and utter disaster, but we'll just have to wait and see.
Well, I think people would have seen, but by now
it's yes, of course, it's Christmas Day.
It's Christmas Day.
Yeah.
Remember the magic of recording beforehand, Terry.
It is. Yeah. Just a bit. Yeah.
Now, you were once Linda's dame in a panto. Now, first off, describe your outfit. Do you look good in tights?
I've got the best legs in the business. I really. Danny LaRue would kill for my legs. He really would. If you like to be a hobbit. Got the hairy feet and everything. I mean, people say that's probably the best thing about me is my legs. I'm quite attached.
Is that the reason why you were so good at being Davros in Doctor Who?
Absolutely, because I could take them off, you know, troll around in that wheelchair, you know, it was great. Yeah, yeah, that's a shame. Davros in tights, it brings up a whole new vision, which I don't think I'll be able to erase from my retina now.
So you reckon you look good in tights. What was the role that you played? And can you remember the year that you were Linda's panto?
I can't. You know, I've been racking my brains to think when it was.
Give us an approximation.
It's got to be around 2007-ish, because it was just after Betty's death. Mm-hmm. And everyone was trying to get him, and he was beginning to have a bit of a flirt with the costume lady, I think, if I remember rightly, at the time. And there was all this sort of is Mike going to, you know, find a new love, you know, after Betty? But he was still mourning Betty, really. And I don't think he was, a bit like Roy has been recently, you know, I don't know if I want to do all this, you know, this dating stuff, you know. It's a rerun of Mike, really, isn't it? And his dating shenanigans. I was looking through things last night, you know, there's no reference that I could find on the web to Mike Tucker in the panto, Ambridge panto.
Well, you know, I had a similar problem, and you look back at the decade recaps or the year recaps, and considering that the panto is a central part of the Ambridge year, they're not there in the recaps, are they?
They're not. No, not in the December runs. No. Mm. I mean, you'd have to ask Camilla. I mean, she was the queen of all things in terms of what happens on the Archers for so many years that she would have made, you know, copious notes about that, I'm sure. Mm-hmm. No, it's bizarre. It's a kind of a blind spot. I kind of remember it, but I don't remember. I don't think I was. I didn't.
Were you?
No, I found it
but,
odd.
But darling, were you a triumph though, darling?
Sorry,
were you a triumph? Were you a success?
I don't know. I don't think I was. I'm being, you know, very, you know, open and honest here. I don't think Mike was a good choice as a dame. He doesn't naturally fit into that slot. You know, Baron Stonybroke or, you know, one of the broker's men maybe, but, you know, the morose one of the broker's men. But as a dame, he's never really been that outgoing, has he? You know.
True. How meta does the acting have to get if you're, you know, putting on a role of somebody who's putting on a role?
Yeah, I mean, this is the difficult one because it's always difficult in situations like that, that you are trying to be an actor putting on an actor who's not acting very well.
Yeah.
And it's... in a sense, you don't play it. You can't play it that way. I always remember Michael Caine saying, you know, how do you play drunk? Don't play drunk. Play as though you believe you're absolutely sober. Mm-hmm. And so everything becomes, you know, very, 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 you know, done in a very particular way because you're trying to prove to everyone else that you're not drunk. And I suppose in the same way that could apply to acting somebody who's acting, that you try and don't act, you act yourself, you act the character, you know, trying to be a character but not, if you know what I mean.
Hmm.
I'm not explaining this very well at all, but yeah, because you've got to have the truth as a character on radio, that you are there as the character, but you're putting on another voice without people saying, oh, he's such a clever actor because he's doing another voice.
Yeah. You know, but no, I think, you know, I hadn't really thought about it until doing the prep for this show. But if you are a television actor, if you're, you know, acting in that role to be a drunk, you've got the visual cues, haven't you?
Yes. Oh, absolutely, yeah.
Whereas with just voice work, it's much more subtle, and you can't just slur every word. It needs to be much more subtle.
No, you've got to be very, very, very precise about what you're talking about. Mm. So people, you know, there's no real, you're not slurring because you're being very, very precise about what you say, because you're not drunk at all. No, there's no, absolutely no belief that you could be drunk. sorry, I dropped off there. It is that. It's radio. You can do these things, but it is really playing against what would naturally be the core to go, oh, I'm being drunk all over the place, because it's kind of meaningless. It's more fun and it's more interesting if you're playing, trying to be not drunk.
Mm.
And I suppose it's the same with a pancho. If I'm trying to be the dame but not be the dame at the same time, gosh, you're getting into areas of real, you know, sort of deep acting psychological psychosis here, aren't we?
Only what the dum-de-dum listeners demand.
I think they do demand it, yeah. I've found most of them fairly psychotic. orientated, yeah.
Now, Ambridge has seen, Terry, some 65 Christmases. So you've been involved in a fair few. With the storylines being produced some 3 months before airing, that means that for the actors, Christmas probably comes in around about October time. Does that mean that that's when you guys all go off down the pub and have the Archers Actors Christmas party?
No, that tends to happen actually in December.
Mm-hmm.
When you're actually recording stuff in January for January. They usually have a, you know, everybody's in the studio, the last studio before Christmas, you know, yeah. Or anybody who isn't, you know, it's basically those people who are in the studio at that time get to go and have a drink with each other should they wish to, you know, or listen to Kerry spinning a few platters, as has happened on one event, you know. It's very much for those people who are there in studio at that time when office parties are happening anyway, you know. I mean, it used to be organised by the BBC, but it's very much now that's not frowned. It's frowned on a bit, that, you know, actually spending money on frivolity like drinking.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of organised, but people pay for it themselves, really. So we just basically go to a restaurant and have a meal together, or, you know, whatever.
So there must have been the odd storyline or two which you can pass on to the listeners of terrible things or that have gone on in the Archers Actors Christmas Party. So, Mr. Malloy, the floor is all yours.
Thank you very much. I mean, there was one that goes down in cast history as, I can't remember the name of the place, but it was within the mailbox complex itself.
Mm-hmm.
And we had hired this place to go and have this meal. And we all turned up there and we waited for ages and ages just to get a drink. And then when things started to arrive, they were wrong. They didn't have the prawns or they didn't have this. Or when they came, they were cold. And it went downhill from there. The service was just abominable,
mm-hmm.
you know. And we decided to bail about halfway through. And we basically, you know, did a mass, you know, a mob attack on, not attack, but a mob, you know, front to the manager and say, look, this is just not acceptable. We will pay you £5 for what we've had per head.
Uh-huh.
That's it. We're out. you know, I don't think that place lasted very long. not because of our action, but no, that was a really memorable one. That, you know, yeah, we did have some really great ones. You know, I've not been to one for years because I've not been in around Christmas for years. So I kind of miss out on some of those. You know, but no, we've had a couple along the canal side there that we had, which were rather good, and. You know, we get people sometimes doing a bit of music themselves, and it can be quite convivial, you know, and it's, you know, an opportunity to let your hair down. I mean, when people get together, when they're in studio, you know, we will, you know, groups of people will go out and have a meal if you're in the next day and you're staying overnight or whatever it may be. So that happens normally, the normal regular run-of-the-mill being in studio at any particular time, but the Christmas party is one where you basically get a bit glammed up, you know, and dressed up, you know, go to the top of the cube or somewhere like that and look out over the city and say, you know, hooray, you know.
It is rather nice up there, isn't it,
around the bag of humbugs, you know.
It is rather nice at the top of the cube. It makes Birmingham look somewhat majestic, doesn't it?
It looks kind of sparkly, doesn't it?
Yeah,
To get that, you know, that vista all the way around, you know, that I've, you know, because I lived in Birmingham for 29 years, yeah, 29 mm-hmm. years. It's good to see it from that perspective. I mean, the highest I'd have been before was in the Lickey Hills, you know, sort of looking out back across Birmingham, but not quite the.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Same as being top of the queue.
In an uncertain world, there is always music which can be listened to in good company. Welcome to Friday 15, the show where we speak to friends and interesting people to the backdrop of great tunes and allocate 15 minutes to both.
I mean, I was 8 years old, interesting, the same age as the Dragon King's daughter when she comes out of the sea. But what was happening to me when I was 8 years old was that I was at the hands of a paedophile in a classroom for a year. And
For me, I think the reason that I somehow managed to win in the end is that for me, it's about an economy of the three things that bring a song together. Kiss, mouth open like
Catch up with me speaking to friends and interesting people every Friday afternoon on Friday 15, which you can get, of course, from a podcatcher of your choice. Now, Mr. Malloy, Mike's major depression, which nearly resulted in him topping himself on Boxing Day 1991, was rather dramatic. And he was talked out of suicide by Kathy Perks. Terry, can you remind us what led Mike to this dark place?
I mean, it came from partly from the fact that he lost his eye as a result of an industrial accident. Well, not lost his eye, but detached retina. as a result of an industrial accident, which eventually led to compensation from Brian Aldridge, which enabled Betty and Mike to buy Willow Farm. But also the fact that he had gone bankrupt. There was a bankruptcy and this you know, industrial accident, and he just got very, very low. And it was a really good storyline, because I mean, when we started doing it, I remember saying to Vanessa, I said, look, this sounds like it's going in a particular direction. Am I right? She said, yeah. It doesn't go into... we're going into the areas of depression, obviously, you know. Whether we go into clinical depression, I said, well, I just need to know where we are in the cycle as we're doing it. And so, mm-hmm. you know, I was fed in information about that. And I believe, I this may be totally apocryphal, and I may be totally wrong about it, but I heard on the grapevine at one point that, in fact, the scriptwriters wanted they wanted me to take my head off with a shotgun on Boxing Day.
Oh, wow.
That's what they planned. And bless her, I think Vanessa turned around and said, no, I like the character and I like the actor. You find another way around it, mm-hmm. Which they did. I don't know how true that is, but it's a nice thought that, you know, dear old Vanessa, she thought, yay, go on, man. Because she's always been very supportive of me. And mm-hmm. It didn't happen, and that Kathy turned it down. But interestingly enough, it was around that time when we did the Murder at Ambridge Hall theatre tour. And I remember we were somewhere in Wales, and I met this vicar, this pastor came up, and he said, can I just thank you for that storyline about the depression that you went through? I said, oh, no, not at all. He said, I was going through exactly the same thing at exactly the same moment as you. And it helped me, because I felt I was with somebody else. I wasn't alone. You know, I wasn't the only one with spots, if you like. And I just thought, wow, that's great that he could relate to what I was going through on the radio, and it was helping him being in the same place at the same time.
So how long was the kind of whole gestation of that storyline before?
It was a good 6 to 9 months almost, I think.
Wow.
Yeah, it was a long burn. It wasn't because you had the whole thing of him doing that and then getting nouty with Betty, and eventually Betty leaving and going to the pub because she couldn't stand it anymore because of his moods and his rages. And then he went and tried to set fire to a farm, and all kinds of things built up to this point where he was on his own on Christmas Day and was going to top himself. And Kathy came round. So
tell us about that scene with Kathy. What do you remember?
You know, I don't remember anything about it now. It was so long ago. Mm. They do tend to merge. I mean, all I know is I think Mike was desolate because he thought he'd lost Betty and the children, you know, Roy and Brenda. Mm-hmm. And he didn't see any point. And I think Kathy was very good at pointing out, I think she bought him a Christmas present. I'm not sure if she didn't buy him a tie. And it was the fact that somebody had bought him something which was, you know, kind of restored his faith a bit, you know, and he, you know, and she persuaded him to, you know, get to talk to Betty again. And so it all began to heal over, you know, but I think it was a turning point. And I just remember it, I love, you know, playing on Mike with Hedley, because she's, you know, she's so lovely as an actress. And, you know, as Kathy, she was, you know, being particularly sympathetic to Mike because of what she was seeing happening, you know, down at the pub and what people had been experiencing around Ambridge at that time. But, it's you get involved in these things and sometimes the details disappear after a while. I'm deeply, you know, full of memories about Betty's death and that sort of thing. But this one, because it was a kind of a denouement, and we knew we were moving on, but with Betty's death, it was an end. And that really did, you know, get to me and Amy as well. Very much so.
Okay, so let's touch on that. So that's Christmas 2005. And I know that we did mention that in our first reminiscence show a couple of months ago. But could you just set the scene for us with that?
Betty had basically a heart attack. You know, she'd been.
And Betty's your first wife.
Yeah, Betty was my first wife. We'd been married. I mean, Betty basically ruled the roost. Mike had came across as this, you know, male chauvinist pig who, you know, basically ruled the roost. But in fact, it was Betty that pulled all the strings, and she mm-hmm. had a you know, lovely, lovely woman. And she moved to Ambridge with Mike. You know, they arrived in Ambridge when Mike took over as herd manager at Brookfield. And then, you know, moved into tenant farming and eventually having their own place and went through all that stuff of, you know, Betty was the solid rock that, you know, survived whenever Mike fell flat on his face, as always happened. I mean, it used to be a joke around that. How do you make the Tuckers millionaires when you start them off as billionaires? Because they'll lose most of it in the first 10 minutes, or Mike will. And she was always there as his rock. And it got to this point where Pam Craig, who'd been in the Archers, you know, as long as I had at that time, she that was all she did, really. She didn't do anything else. And she, her husband had family in New Zealand, and they were thinking of, they were both retired, he was retired, they were thinking of moving back to New Zealand, which meant, obviously, that Pam couldn't carry on doing Betty, and so talked it through with Vanessa, and there was discussion obviously as whether they find another Betty, but we thought that's ridiculous after 34 years, you know, you can't do that. So Vanessa said, well, can we kill you off? And Pam said, yeah, if that's all right with Terry. And I said, well, I'm not all right with me, but I realize the reason you want to go. So we went into the storyline of Betty getting a bit ill and having a heart attack, which she recovers from, you know. Mm-hmm. So everyone thinks, wow, it's great. She's fine. She's absolutely fine. Went to hospital. We got it all sorted. She's back home, you know. And everyone's going, phew. And then, bang, she just drops dead. You know, when she goes upstairs to change, she's dead. And it was a tough one to do, you know. I mean, Pam actually insisted on staying, although she wasn't in the episode or the scene, for the scene where we actually found her dead, lying on the sofa, you know. Mm-hmm. We had a great, great family, you know, all of us as actors. It was a great family, and I think that you do find that with the various families, you know. There's a camaraderie of the people who are in those families. Mm. And it was...
Do you think that camaraderie is important to when you emote, when you actually act with, you know, opposite your, you know, your screen, son, or radio daughter, radio wife?
Yeah, it was for me, certainly. I couldn't do the things I did do with Pam and with Ian and with Amy had there not been a great friendship between us all as well. Mm. As, you know, just being very, very good actors. You know, I mean, the scene when Mike, Amy, or Brenda finds Mike in the bedroom, and he can't think of what to wear for the funeral. You know, because Amy had that year lost her mum in mm-hmm. real life. It was very raw. And there was all that emotion there and all that emotion being put into it. We both said, look, we don't want to rehearse this. In fact, we just want to, you know, just have a quiet time in the studio and we'll do it. And that was the take they took, because it had all those you know, those resonances between the two of us, in that I'd lost an actress wife. Mm-hmm. Who I'd been married to longer than anybody I'd been married to. And it was a very special relationship over all those years. And Amy had lost an actor mum, and she'd also lost her real mum. So she knew those emotions. She knew those feelings. Mm-hmm. So we actually went to opposite sides of the studio and just took our own time and came back together and did it. And that was just, you know, I mean... Kerry, Kerry had written the scripts, done some cracking scripts for that whole section of Betty's death, and they just sang. You know when a script sings and when one's a bit clunky, but these scripts were singing, you know. And it's also interesting, I mean, when Roy came into the programme, when he was first cast, you know, it was getting to that time where we ought to have a, you know, a speaking tucker. And so they auditioned people. And then I was there doing the auditions at Pebble Mill. And they had a range of actors coming in. And they were very, very good. You know, a whole tranche of about six or eight actors came in. And in those days, they were just recorded blind. And the tapes were sent to Vanessa to listen to without any names or anything like that. It was a bit like the old brass bands where they sit behind a screen so they don't know who's actually playing. Mm-hmm. And she would then choose from the voices. But the last person of the day was Ian Pepperell. He came in, and the minute he opened his mouth and started to speak, the hairs went up on the back of my neck, because I thought, my God, that's me 20 years ago. Wow. And then, my God, I've been in the program that long. You know, because you don't notice time passing. Mm-hmm. Except suddenly you've got a son that is now, you know, sounding like you, you know, and you think, oh, God, you know. So those are special moments. Those are really special moments when you have that relationship with the person that you're working with, who's also meant to be a member of your family. And the same with Amy. I mean, Amy still calls me dad, you know, to each other. You know, I'm her other dad. And it's great. It's great to have that ongoing relationship.
Absolutely. And what's she working on at the moment? What's she up to?
Who, Amy?
Yeah.
She's just had a play on in London, you know, very successful and had a very good run. And she's doing a lot of writing. Mm-hmm. And stuff like that. We keep in touch, you know, and say, will the Tuckers ever come back? Well, we hope so. Maybe, who knows? You know, it's one of those imponderables. We just we wait and see.
Now, after Christmas comes New Year. Now, you have a little bit of a plot prediction, don't you, about New Year's?
Mm. Yeah, I have lots of predictions about the Archers. I play silly games of what ifs. Mm-hmm. And I mean, for years, and you can ask Pat Gallimore this, but Pat Gallimore and I put together this concept that, in fact, Helen Archer is Pat and Mike's love child. And you go back, you know, you go back in time. It was the time when, you know, Mike had his organic thing, and you know, every time Tony arrived, you know, Mike was delivering some vegetables to Pat, and I'd say, oh, better go. Right, see you, Pat. Yeah, all right. You know. So we're convinced that, A, Helen is Mike and Pat's love child, and in fact, John tipped over the tractor because he actually saw them bonking in the back of a Land Rover. So that's how he actually died. You know, these are these little fantasy football, but fantasy archers that we play. Yeah.
So how's this story going to get out? How's the truth going to out?
Oh, I don't know. I keep on saying, and Julie Beckett used to keep on slapping us both. I said, oh, shut up, you're not doing it. I said, but it's true. It's got to be true. It's got to be, you know, really, honestly, you know, really, honestly. No, it's just us playing around, which is great fun. Now, I was just thinking, this coming New Year, mm-hmm. wouldn't it be good if... Lower Loxley... Mm-hmm. If a certain young lady took a certain young doctor up on the roof to show him where her first husband slipped and fell, uh-huh. and David sees them going up there and follows them up to say, you know, what's going on, and as a result, we have Dr. Locke fall off as well. so you've got another death on New Year's Eve, you know, at Lower Loxley. Which then has this wonderful ongoing story of you know, of Eddie Grundy, you know, every doing ghost walks around Ambridge, you know, and here we are on Lower Loxley, you know, and there's the ghosts of Nigel Pargeter and Dr. Locke walking the parapets on New Year's Eve. you know, you've got this, so, you know, anybody who goes near Elizabeth Pargeter ends up dying by falling off the roof of Lower Loxley. That's just the way my mind works, I think, half the time. But of course, Mike nearly got killed as well on New Year's Eve, courtesy of Helen, his supposed daughter. Well, in our supposition, supposed daughter. But I suppose everyone plays these games. I'm sure I know a lot of Dumpty Dummers do. And I'm certainly, you know, other areas of archers, you know, anarchists and people like that will be quite happy to sort of run those sort of little scenarios past the post. But it keeps us all sane. It's just another level of Ambridge jollity I like.
Listen, I like it too. Now, just before we say goodbye, I presume you're sat there. Well, how much of this do we project onto our recording? So we're sat together, of course.
Yes.
With a couple of mince pies between us, paper hat.
Yep.
I don't know how I'm going to get back to my mar and pa's in Birmingham.
Yes.
Because there's no public transport on Christmas Day. But I'm going to have to set off. So what are you going to do for the rest of your evening?
Oh, rest of the evening. I think it's...
Is it Doctor Who on the telly?
Well, there's Doctor Who on the telly, yes. I mean, I don't watch it a vast amount now, but I mean, it is a Christmas special, so I suppose I will. And I do like Peter Capaldi, so I mean, he's great. So, yeah, I guess there's going to be that. And then I thought, you know...
I tell you what, Terry, I feel that I shouldn't ask you this, but I'm going to anyway. Who's your favourite Doctor?
Dr. Mortlock. She's great. Great GP. She's saved me many.
I'm referring to, sir.
Good Doctor. My favourite Doctor, it's the Doctor that people grow up with. It always is. Your first Doctor is your favourite Doctor. You can't get around that, even if you were.
All right, okay, all right.
So for
post the relaunch.
I have to admit, I'm old enough to have been 16 when Doctor Who started. So
post the relaunch. Let's make it much more controversial then.
Yeah.
Who's your favourite Doctor?
Who's my favourite Doctor?
Since the relaunch, yep.
Oh, since the relaunch?
Yep.
Oh, God. Capaldi.
Why?
He incorporates all the Doctors in a very subtle way. He's a terrific actor. I like them all. I mean, the Doctors are the Doctor, the Doctor. I loved Eccleston. I thought Eccleston was so badly done by people, you know. And
he doesn't get the plaudits, really, does he?
And he was so good. I thought he was really, really good. I mean, I remember that the look in his eye when he saw the first Dalek that was chained up in the cellar was pure fear, and it was pure fear. And I thought, that's good. That is, you know, he really was on blob. And they all bring their own thing to it, you know. David's such a lovely man, David Tennant, you know. And I went to see, I was doing a Doctor Who Confidential in Cardiff when he was doing his very final day in studio, just doing pickups in the TARDIS with Graham Harper, who was the director who directed me in Revelation with Colin Baker years before. And I could see he was eyeing me across the floor, you know. And I thought, oh, well, I know he's a fanboy, and you know, maybe that, you know. Anyway, he came chasing over in one of the breaks and said, "Terry, how are you, man?" I said, "Yeah, it's really great to see you." And I'm going, "Oh, hey, great, yeah, lovely, thank you, David, and you." You know, he says, "God, it's so long since we worked together, isn't it?" "Oh, dear. Oh, yeah, that was on what was, you know, the sea. We did the sea." And we did. Years before, we'd done Wilson had done a radio production of Edward Bond's The Sea.
Mm.
And he and I were, you know, part of the Suffolk Villagers. I mean, the thing I really remember, right, it was, you know, Anton Lesser and Rosemary Leach as the, you know, the main protagonist. And, you know, like a lot of radio plays, and like we've been discussing tonight about, you know, going back to 1991, I forget things that we've done in, you know, and nine times out of 10, 2 days after I've been in the studio, you know, people say, "Oh, you remember that thing we did last week?" I go, "No." Well, we just want to get that voice again. I said, "Well, you have to play it to me because I can't remember now." It's a bit like a computer. Your brain shuts down once you go out of the studio and you're on to the next thing because things were run so fast. I mean, David's a lovely man. David's, you know, Superman. I've never met Matt, but it was interesting that when Capaldi was announced, Colin Baker is quoted as saying, "Ah, at last we've got a Doctor over the age of 12.
Which I actually said
with great love because he likes both Matt and David very well.
I actually thought that was the whole point of the regeneration, that actually the Doctors got younger. And I was actually thrown for a loop when Capaldi got it.
No, No, they don't get younger because they are actually older. And what I'd like them to actually eventually discover is that room in the TARDIS that nobody talks about, mm-hmm. which is the regeneration room. Because in that regeneration room are all the old doctors. And they have aged. Naturally. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So in that regeneration room, once the doctor regenerates, they go into the regeneration room and the next one takes over. So all the old regenerations of the doctor are in that room. Now, wouldn't that be an interesting episode to do?
We're going to have to do a new podcast.
Oh, you're going to have to do a new podcast, yes. The 13 Doctors,
Did we actually decipher what you're going to do when I leave your little cottage in Norfolk?
It's
Christmas evening.
No. I'm going to, as I said, probably watch a bit of Doctor Who and, mm-hmm. Find a frivolous family film to watch like 1984. I think that would be good, yeah. Right. I don't know.
And cuddle up to the missus.
And cuddle up to the missus, absolutely. I think I'm full of mince pies now. I don't think I can manage another one. But if you tempt me with the brandy butter, I think I might.
Terry Molloy, thank you for your Christmas reminiscences, sir.
Thank you, Royfield, and a happy Christmas to everyone.
Now, I just need to do a little bit of shopkeeping. Dumdydum.com, go there. We've got a shop. It's awesome. Got a forum. You can go onto our forum. You can tell us how wonderful you thought this Christmas show was. So that'd be a good thing to do. iTunes reviews, everybody. Don't give us money. Don't send us presents. Send us an iTunes review because that's really good to keep us on top of those iTunes podcast charts. Couple of shows you can help keep our little show on the road. You can do it by hitting that donate button, or you can go onto patreon.com and donate a couple of dollars per show. Now, to get in contact with us, you can send us a voice message via SpeakPipe on our website, which is of course dumdydum.com, or you can call us on 0203 031 3105 to leave us a telephonic message. You can find us on social media, specifically Twitter, where we are at dumdydum. Me, I'm at Royfield. Harriet is at Sambridges. Lucy is Lucy V Freeman. And Terry, how can people find you on the Twitters?
At Tucker's Patch. Do you get it? Tucker's Patch.
Hey. On Facebook. You can go and join some 1,500 people that kind of dumdy-dum all together who are corralled by a one Millie Bell. That's just about it. Have you got any last comments you'd like to give the dumdy-dummers out there, Terry?
I'd just like to say I think dumdy-dum is brilliant, and I think you're all brilliant. And I pick up on some of the comments now and again. I'm not an avid listener, but when I do, I do enjoy myself. I think it's a top podcast. You're fantastic for doing it. You and Lucy and everyone, you pitch in, and it's great that you keep the program alive and kicking alongside the program that is alive and kicking, but it extends it out. It's a bit of what we tried to do with Archer's Addicts back in the day, just have more of an interaction between the cast and the fans. And you're all great, and I hope that Mike, whoever, Vicky, Bethany, whatever, Amy, Brenda, will all sometime get together in Ambridge and wish you a Merry Christmas next year.
That would be a perfect way to round off 2017. Fingers crossed for that, Mr. Molloy.
Yep.
Thanks a lot, mate. You take care. Have a very merry rest of your Christmas.
Thank you.
Perfect. Didn't even need Tim at all.
Oh.
Tim Bentinck, what? Who?
Tim Bentinck, what? No. Arches, isn't he?
Here's a cool fact.
A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.